Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. We seem to be having a little technical difficulty with our music introduction today, but we have our guest online, and we're going to go right ahead and welcome our audience to another exciting episode. And remember that the slogan for our show is, if there's power in numbers, the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative captures that power for your financial benefit. Well, as I indicated to our listening audience and those who follow us here on the airways of Blog Talk Radio, we are streaming live from your nation's capital. Today is July the 19th, 2017, and you can be, this format can be heard over the airways of Facebook, Twitter, streaming live, as well as we're broadcasting through the Blog Talk Radio format. And for our listening audience, you can call in by calling us at 646-668-2948. That's 646-668-2948. And as I was saying, we have a very, very, very exciting show for our listening audience today. But first, we need to take care of a little homework, and that's always important because this show is sponsored by the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, and our sole objective is to increase awareness and engagement in the African American community of what is going on in the solar and renewable energy industry. We are a purchasing cooperative, and our sole purpose is to increase the market share for those African-American-owned solar installation companies doing business here in the continental U.S. We also are sponsored by the Black Sports Legends Foundation, BSLS HBCU Solar Initiative. And we have a new sponsor, Staten Communications Network, specializing in the following areas: public relations, writing, editing, web development, web editing, magazine production, online and newsletter production, speech writing, book writing, editing, publishing, speaker bureau management. For contact information, you can contact ScottonCommunicationsNetwork.com. That's ScottonCommunicationsNetwork.com. And please remember that our website is the Positive Change PC.com. That's Positive Change PC.com. And without further ado, I'm going to bring up our first guest. We have with us today the privilege of having this Betty Ann Kane, who's who is now serving as the Commissioner of the Public Service Commission here in Washington, D.C. She was appointed commissioner in March of 2007, where she became chair in March of 2039. She has a very, very career in public service because Chairman Betty Ann Kane is experienced in public affairs, combining over 40 years in service in the District of Columbia. She was elected as an appointed position with extensive private sector experience in regulatory, administrative, and public policy matters. Before joining the PSC, Chairman Kane served as trustee and executive director for the District of Columbia Retirement Board. She served for 4 years at large as a member of the D.C. Board of Education and was elected 3 terms at large member of the D.C. Council. Her service on the council included chairing the Public Service Commission, Cable Television Committee, legislative, budgetary, and oversight responsibility for Public Service Commission, the Office of the People's Council, and the Office of Cable Television. Betty and Kane is a member of the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, NARUCA Board of Directors, a member of the NARUCA Telecommunications Committee, and the NARU appointee to the Vital Working Group on Education Training and the Best Practices for the International Confederation of Energy Regulators and Treasury of the National Regulatory Research Institute, the research arm of NARUC. Additionally, she is in the past chairman of the board in RRI and the past president of the Mid-Atlantic Conference on Regulatory Utilities Commission. Chairman Kane also served two FCC-appointed positions as chairman of the North American Numerary Council and the member of the Joint Conference on Advanced Telecommunications and Service. She graduated from Middleburg College in Vermont and has a master's degree in English from Yale and has a specialized academic study in telecommunication regulatory from Augsburg School of Investing and Finance at Wharton School, the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you once again, Chairman Kane, for joining us on the airways of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America.
I'm pleased to be here. Thank you very much for that very long introduction.
Well, it's a long introduction, but I tried to get it in as quickly as possible because
yeah,
I want to get right down, cut right, as we say, drill down to this interview because I think it's very, very important. D.C. customers pay $15 million extra because of shortfall in D.C.-based solar facilities. The letter you sent to Chairman Mendelson, D.C. Council, to reverse the $7.5 million from the Renewable Energy Fund and reprogram it to the District General Fund. And I'm not going to read this letter today because I have so many times in the past. But, Kane, would you please share with our listening audience why you sent this letter and the impact this letter had? Because I think it had a tremendous impact because the city council put back $2.5 million out of that $7.5. So
right. That's
a lot of money, as tight as things are in this marketplace. So please, would you explain what this whole situation is about with the Renewable Development Fund and how this thing plays out as it affects our working, listening, D.C. hardworking citizens, D.C. government hardworking employees, and federal government hardworking employees, how it affects them in their pockets?
Sure, and I will say it affects them directly in two ways, in their pockets and in their ability to trust that the D.C. government is going to do what it says it's going to do with money that it makes people pay into a fund. Real quick, the Renewable Energy Development Fund is a fund that was set up by law passed by the D.C. City Council a number of years ago to have money that could be used to help low-income people in particular take advantage of the savings and the clean energy that comes from renewable energy, and particularly solar. And the money in the fund comes from a fee that every one of the companies that sells electricity in the district has to pay when they can't buy enough renewable energy credits. And so all the companies that sell electricity to everyone in the district, whether you're a renter, a homeowner, a business, whatever, they all have to provide a certain percentage of the electricity comes from renewable sources. And they buy credits from the providers of those renewable sources and prove that they've bought the renewable energy. If they can't buy the credits, and in particular there aren't enough solar credits available because there aren't enough solar facilities in the district to sell them the credits, they have to pay a fee, an alternative fee. And that fee goes into this renewable development fund. And the purpose of the fund is that the money in there is supposed to be used to help people do solar so they can have solar, so people can sell the credits, so they don't have to have the compliance fee paid. And the amount that was paid in year before last was about $19 million. In 2016, it was $15 million. Now, this is money that gets, it's sort of part of the electricity. It's part of the cost of electricity. Matter of fact, electricity is about 10% higher in the district because of this law and because of the fees. And what has happened, what happened this year, the money was building up in the fund. It wasn't being used as quickly as people would have liked, maybe, to get it out, although a lot of solar has been built. And the council sat there and looked at it and said, oh, well, this is extra money. Let's take it and use it for something else. And they were going to take $7.5 million of it, put it into the general fund where it kind of goes for anything, just regular stuff in the D.C. government. And I objected. The commission objected. This has been done before with other funds that electricity and gas payers pay into. A little money's left over at the end of the year. It's supposed to be left over at the end of the year, but they scoop it up and use it for something else, which means next year people have to pay all over again into the fund in order to do what it's supposed to be used for.
Well, Chairman Kane, I had the privilege of having the director of the Department of Energy and Environment on my show, Director Tommy Wells. And I'm certainly going to share with our listening audience that Tommy Wells was very, very straightforward when he mentioned the fact that the legislative branch, which is the city council, and I know you served on the council as well as a former Director Wells served on the council. So you both know how the process works, and you know the timelines, and you know the budgetary fiscal year dates. And it seems to me that it's unconscionable because that members of the city council would continuously, because this is not like this has been a first-time thing, you have had an auditor which your agency has brought on to look at that renewable energy development, almost, it was over $40 million that has been reprogrammed since the inception of this fund. Now, I think there's a direct correlation when the legislative branch turns around and says to the executive branch, which the mayor's office and the D.C. government agencies come under, well, the money's not going out of the door of DOEE fast enough, but they can't write blank checks to a vendor to do work unless the vendor first performs the job and then brings back the invoices, as well as they have to have an inspection process to make sure that the work has been done and done correctly. And this all takes time when you're talking about the 50% renewable portfolio standards, which have been passed by the legislative branch and signed off by the executive office. I mean, Washington, D.C., has a very robust renewable portfolio standard requirement of 50%. And when you begin to look at 600,000 population base, and that you, this money was supposed to be used to help lower the utility bills for 100,000 low and moderate income residents in the District of Columbia, Chairman Wells also shared with us the fact that Grid Alternatives had received a $950,000 grant, but that's an award. But if they're going to put train 75 DC residents on become PV installers, and you're going to assist 100 DC residents to get PV systems, that is not going to be rolled out overnight. So how does this process mesh when it becomes what you indicated in your letter is that you need to have a balance in this fund, and this money shouldn't be tampered with so this work can go on 12 months again, because it's going to take that to meet these timelines.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And the legislation, when the fund was set up, when this fund and the Sustainable Energy Trust Fund and the Energy Assistance Trust Fund, which are also funds, which is the total $40 million, was taken over the years from all three of those funds, the council specifically set it up and specifically wrote into the law, number one, it can only be used for these particular purposes, and number two, that it exists what's called without fiscal year limitation, which means the whole plan from the beginning, and as just as you said, and as Director Wells said, a recognition that you can't start and stop and start and stop. If you're going to plan, let's say, for example, they did 130 roofs, solar roofs, in Ward 7 and 8 across the river last year. Well, that took some planning. That took enrolling people. That took checking out the roofs. That took making sure that people understood, make sure that you had the right contractors in place. And so the whole purpose of having this is what's called a trust fund, which you're supposed to trust that the money's going to stay in the fund, is so that it will be there, whether it takes 12 months or 15 months. So you can plan ahead. So you can say, okay, we'll do this much this year and save this much and do it next year. And that's the big concern about this. If you call it a trust fund, they're supposed to be held in trust and you should trust the money to be there by law. And then when you come in at the end of the year and say, oh, well, doesn't matter what the law says, we'll change the law temporarily and take the money away. It's appalling. And the audit was done was actually the council's own DC auditor who we asked to do. We didn't even go outside. It was their own auditor that said this had been happening. You know, I guess the example would be, let's say you're saving for college, and you're putting money away each year for your kid for college. Well, you get to the end of the year and maybe they didn't need it all for tuition this year, but they might need it next year. Well, do you want someone to come and take that money away because you didn't spend it that year, but you know they've got three more years of college left? So it's the trust factor here. If you're going to take the money from people, if you're going to make the suppliers pay it, if you're going to make it be part of the electric bill, then use it for what it's supposed to be used for, and don't fool people.
Well, see, that is what is so dis to me, because I have been beating the drum about getting more workforce development training to the solar companies themselves. They don't have apprentice programs in place. They don't have workforce development training programs in place. I had Mr. Sean O'Brien from the North American Board of Energy Practitioners he had a scheduled interview. We had some technical problems, and I just simply couldn't pull him up. So he never actually did the interview on the show, but he was came on the airways, and we couldn't get it out. But I'm going to have him back on. And the reason why his organization is so important, because they do the certification for Canada, U.S., Central America, all North America. The North American Board of Energy Practitioners have designed, and they are responsible for the certification of curriculum, which they offer these courses through Caitlin University through El Paso, Texas. Now, the problem comes in when you go to their website and you find out that in the District of Columbia, we have a population of almost 600,000 people, but you only have people who are certified with the North American Board of Energy Practitioners. And if you offer these courses in a classroom, on a campus, or on a high school, that course has to be supervised by a person with them with their certification. Their certification through them. Clearly, there's not enough certified individuals to oversee this training. And in the same in Maryland and in Virginia. I looked at the numbers for the state of Maryland with almost a 6 million population. They had around 50-something people. And in Virginia, with almost a 9 million population for this whole state of Virginia, you had 73 people. I mean, this is sort of absurd because these individuals with those certifications, they can do so many different things with their time to make money. But when you don't have the workforce development training component in place because there's no funding or the $500 million that came from the through way of the Sunshine Identity Initiative, through DOE, and went out to all 50 states, and each jurisdiction, I understand, with it concluding the District of Columbia, received $10 million in workforce development training. It has been very baffling to me what happened to this $500 million and where is the training component to assist getting our young people trained and our workforce trained, and specifically in the African-American community, our young people trained, because when you look at the solar and renewable energy statistical data, Abe put out a report that indicated that African-Americans, which is very dated, but in 2009, we spent $41 billion for energy, but we only had 1.1% of the jobs and had 0.8% of the wealth in the industry. Fast forward 2015, the Solar Foundation puts out a report that says you had 260,000+ people working in the industry, 23.8% women, you had 11.3% Hispanics, 8.3% Pacific Islands Asians, and 8.1% veterans. But when it came to the African American community, here we bring up the bottom of the barrel again at 6.6%. It's mind-boggling to me why we don't have more people raising HELLs. You can talk about all the STEM education you want to, but the solar and renewable energy industry, according to SEIA report and looking at a recent data that was put out, people can go to our website at positivechangepc.com, click on news and events, and scroll down. You'll find that the Rural Co-ops had a report out saying that the electrical industry, electricity generated $364 billion in this country, but solar and renewable energy generated $200 billion of that. So without question, Washington, D.C. is one of the top solar markets in the nation based on having all of the legislation that you need to create this solar market. It's one of the top in the country. But when you're talking about $500 per cert solar renewable credit, that is one of the, you only have four other jurisdictions in the nation that have a that value placed on a kilowatt cert value, whether it comes from wind, turbine, hydrogenetics. Well, this is not Kansas, and we certainly not, we don't have moving water on the Anacostia, so hydraulics piece on this is not going to generate the search value that you're going to get from solar here. So I don't understand what these issues are. We are joined by our guest that we will a caller. Good afternoon, caller. Well, why are we waiting for them to come on in? Well, Chairman, Kane, would you please go on and give us a little more insight about this area?
Sure. I certainly agree with you on workforce development. The district government did get $5 million from Exelon Corporation as part of their promises, their pledges when the merger was approved by the commission. And that $5 million is supposed to be used for workforce development for utility workers. It's not under the control of the D.C. Public Service Commission. It went to the mayor and to the Department of Employment Services. So be worth following up. How are they using that money? What are they using it for in terms of training people? There are good jobs, not just in solar, but, you know, linemen with Pepco and gas pipeline for Washington Gas, which is doing a lot of construction. We have a big undergrounding project coming. And, of course, D.C. Water is doing a lot of construction. So there's lots of need for trained people to do utility work in solar, in electricity, in power, in water, and in gas. And I absolutely agree that that's an important priority. And some of this money to do the Sustainable Energy Trust Fund, which has got $20 million a year, paid for by electricity and gas customers. It goes as a surcharge on your gas bill and on your electric bill, over $20 million a year. A portion of that, I believe, to at least 20%, is supposed to be used for creating jobs. So it requires, shall we say, eternal vigilance to see that the money gets used in the way that it's supposed to. I will say the Sustainable Energy Utility is using the money as it is intended on the latest audit that we've had of that.
Well, Chairman Kane, we have just a few minutes left, and 30 minutes goes so fast. But I want to shift this just briefly. District of Columbia regulator seeks to enhance retail energy consumer protections. Could you just go into that just a little bit? Because this comes under your oversight also there at the Public Service Commission.
Sure. As I said at the beginning, PEPCO is a monopoly in the district in terms of delivering electricity. They do the wires, they do the conduit, they do the metering, they do the billing. But PEPCO does not produce electricity, and PEPCO does not sell electricity. And people can buy their electricity from anyone who's licensed by us. And because there is consumer choice, we have put in place consumer protection rules so that the companies, so that we know that the companies that are selling electricity, marketing electricity, are doing it in a fair way, that the contracts are things that people understand, and that they're real companies that have some financial stability to them. Even people who don't choose a company and are by default then put into what's something called standard office service, PEPCO manages it, but it comes from electricity from three or four other different companies that are actually providing the electricity. So we periodically review our consumer protection laws, and we have made some changes in terms of bonds, in terms of making sure, again, that the companies that are selling electricity are stable, that they're treating customers right, and that customers have a way to register complaints and concerns and get information about each of the companies and about their prices. So we just updated those rules.
Well, I know that this work is very, very challenging, because I came to one of your public meetings and you were taking suggestions and asking the general public for feedback and trying to get people engaged, and that's what this whole show is about. And I truly, truly want to thank you for taking time from your very, very busy schedule to come on the airways of Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America and share with the listening audience here in this DMV market area specifically to D.C. residents, the impact that this renewable energy industry and the renewable energy portfolio radio standards with net metering laws and community solar laws. Everything is in place. But when you create this marketplace, you must have enough facility in order for that utility provider to be able to buy these kilowatt hours from. And when that doesn't happen, then they're fine. And you've got to have those fines to create this market. So it can become a very, very vicious cycle. And I want to thank you for shining the light on this situation as it's been, as it affects D.C. consumers, everyday hardworking class folks of all races, creeds, and denominations. Because one thing for sure, everybody got to pay the utility bill. Because when you go into that room and you hit that light switch in the dark, if the light doesn't come on and you don't have heat or air conditioning, depending on the time of year it is, we know that's an issue, a very basic issue of survival. So what you do is very, very important, Director, and I want to thank you for what you do every day, and thank you for coming on these airways and sharing this information with the listening public.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Let me just say, if people want more information, the phone number at the commission is 202-626-5100, 626-5100, and then our website has a wealth of information at dcpsc.org, dcpsc.org. We are happy to come out to the community, to come out to meetings, and to share any information and answer any questions, whether it's individual consumer complaint or consumer concern or a general topic that you'd like a speaker on.
Well, once again, you heard it directly from the Director of the Public Service Commission, the Honorable Betty Ann Kane, and this lady, I know she's a fighter, and I'm proud to say that I've had the opportunity to sort of mix it up in front of the council over the years, testifying, trying to advocate for DC taxicab drivers in this city. So we're not strangers, so, and you won't be a stranger to the airways of this show. Anytime you need this show, Chairman Kane, all you got to do is give us a call, reach out. We would love to have you here, and I want to. I'll be giving you a call because I'm working on some projects with two of our universities here in the city, and I think it's something that your organization would be very, very supportive for. It will help resolve the issue of facility, lack of facility for PEPCO to be able to find a supplier to buy the shirts from. So I will be contacting you about that. And once again, thank you for joining the airways of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America.
Thank you.
All right. And that was our first guest, Director of the Public Service Commission. We now have on hand our second guest for our show, next portion of our show, which is Mr. Warren Leon, Executive Director of Clean Energy States Alliance. Good day, Mr. Warren Leon.
Hey, good day to you as well.
Well, I think you were listening in on our previous interview with our director of the Public Service Commission and her fight here, and I know that's what your organization does every day also, but you do it in a sort of different arena. Let me sort of give individuals who are listening to our show little background. Mr. Warren Leon is Executive Director of the Clean Energy States Alliance. He oversees the organization's day-to-day operations and leads the strategy development. He directs Garcia's RPS Collaborative. He has written and edited many reports for SEAL, including Clean Energy Champions, the importance of the state programs and policies. He is an adjunct professor at Brandeis International Business School. Prior to working with SEAL, Warren was director of the Massachusetts Renewable Energy Trust, executive director of the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association, and deputy director for programs at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He co-authored an influential book, Consumer's Guide to Effective Environmental Choices. He holds a PhD from Harvard University. And I wanted to do a proper introduction, sir. But would you see your works with state leaders, federal agencies, industry responsibilities, and other stakeholders to develop, promote clean energy technologies and markets. It supports effective state and local policy programs and innovations in the clean energy generation sector with an emphasis on renewable energy financing strategies and economic development. Now, for Six Pack Joe, would you make it plain, Leon, what actually, how does this policy and what does your organization do that impact on the pocketbooks of our everyday consumers?
Hey, thanks for asking that question. That's an important one. Our organization, CESA, the Clean Energy States Alliance, we mostly operate behind the scenes providing advice to state governments and other public agencies to help them develop strong, effective clean energy programs on solar, but also on other topics. And we, the type of thing that will happen is one of our members, say somebody from the D.C. Department of Energy and Environment, will call us up and say, hey, we're thinking of starting a new community solar program. Can you tell us what other states have good community solar programs that we could learn from? What are some best practices? What are some lessons learned? Can you give us some advice? And we do a lot of networking and discussions behind the scenes among these folks. And in terms of what your listeners may be interested in terms of how it could affect them and their pocketbooks, a significant number of our member states these days are very interested in this issue of how do you make solar benefit low and moderate income households and communities. They're all trying to figure out the best strategies for that. And we have a program called the Sustainable Solar Education Project, which educates people on what's going on around the country related to solar for low and moderate income consumers and what are some lessons learned there. And we do a monthly newsletter about what's going on around the country on that topic. And any of your listeners can sign up to receive that free newsletter at CESA.org. CESA.org, and it's the Sustainable Solar Education Project.
Would you give that information again and slow down a little bit because some of our listeners they probably can't write as fast as you are talking. So I understand that. So please give that information again.
I'm happy to do that. So the website where you could sign up for our free newsletter is at CESA.org for Clean Energy States Alliance, CESA.org, and look for the Sustainable Solar Education Project. That project reports on news on two topics. One is low-income solar, and the other is solar consumer protection. Both of those topics should be of great interest to your listeners. And in addition to the newsletter, we do periodic webinars and presentations on what's going on around the country related to those topics?
Well, I am very, very glad to know that your organization is doing things to try to educate the low and moderate income communities in this across this country. Because one of the things that I've learned with this show, it is very, very, very difficult in the African-American community to get the powers to be in media. And I've contacted a number of radio shows and trying to get on various talk shows to talk about this particular format, Solar Now, and the future with its economic impact on Black America. Because when I originally scheduled this show and formatted this show, I brought the show to fruition to give African Americans working in the solar and renewable energy industry an opportunity and a platform and a voice to speak about what they see and experience every day. But we are open-minded, and we know that everyone can contribute to, regardless of race or gender, to advocating for the same issues in this clean energy economy. This is a new paradigm. And as I was explaining to the listening audience a little earlier, and they can call in at by calling 646-2948. And remember, you can log on to our website at www.positivechangepc.com, and you click on our news and events tab, and you will see a article that we have downloaded on the Clean Energy State Alliance, SEA, and what they do. And they do an outstanding job. But as this gentleman has said, Mr. Warren, Leon Warren, has said, they are behind the scenes. And you will find that most of the decisions and the policies that are being made are being made behind the scenes without people who look like me of color involved in a lot of these decisions. Now, one of the issues that I have had is the fact that all of this growth in this solar and renewable energy industry, and according to SEIA, and according to a report that was put out by the Department of Energy, this came to fruition because of President Barack Obama and the Sunshine Identity Initiative, which people can find in front of our website, because not only did the Green Jobs Act, which was signed into law by George Walker Bush in 2007, after the very, very embarrassing situation of how he handled the Katrina disaster in New Orleans that affected folks of my community and my race, the African American community, and Van Jones, who was the author of several best-selling books, got that Green Jobs Act signed into law, which codified the green jobs in the U.S. It had to be codified before it would take off, and it resulted in $500 million in workforce development training. As I look across the landscape and I look at the public policy as it relates to the African-American community, looking at the new technologies that are now here, a gentleman by the name of Mr. George Siever has said the great energy disturbance, and he talked about transportation and energy. And one of the things he was talking about, the impact of the EV, the electric vehicles, that they would have on the society. Also, he looked at and he talked about, well, what's the issue of getting these vehicles into the marketplace? Well, they're the charging station infrastructure Well, when you drive 95 south, you don't find any charging stations on I-95 and I-85. But when you get north, you do. Well, the reason why is because of legislation. This is what this gentleman does. The southern states don't have renewable portfolio status. The 19 states where 65% of the African-American population in this country does not have renewable portfolio standard regulations or net metering or community solar legislation in place. And it's a direct correlation with economics and how it plays into growing this industry. So would you please share that, Mr. Warren, Leon, would you please talk about that briefly?
Yeah, no, you make a number of very good points, and your efforts to try to bring these issues to the attention of the public is very noteworthy and is very important. Well, you know, some of the issue of why there hasn't been as much focus on solar and renewable energy in the South has to do with two factors. One is in some of those states, there is not very good resources for wind energy. And early on when states were implementing renewable portfolio standards, the focus was on wind. And now solar has been coming down and it's more cost effective. And that's a good reason for states to promote it. There are good ways to implement it. But some of the states in the South are making some progress with implementing solar energy now. They're just not doing it through a renewable portfolio standard. Some of the utilities are interested in it. And the reason they're interested in it is not primarily for environmental reasons or workforce development, but solar is becoming cost-effective. And the second thing is the public likes it. And, you know, like other businesses, utilities want to be popular with their audience, and so they want to implement solar because the public's interested in that.
Well, sir, look, as I drill down on interviews, I'm cutting to the chase. I'm looking at a study that was put out by American Association of Blacks in Energy, AIBE, and they indicated that African Americans, we spent $41 billion in this country in 2009, and I have been talking after Mr. Tracy Woods to get them to do something, who's the operational manager for the American Association of Blacks in Energy. They definitely need to go back to the drawing board and come up with some newer statistical data to show the economic output spent by the African American. Because as I said, in 2009, allegedly based on the statistical information that they supplied, that African Americans spent $41 billion, had 1.1% of the jobs, and 0.8% of the wealth. We have no one in the supply chain out of 9,929 solar installation companies. This data is put out by the Solar Foundation. We only have 9,929 solar installation companies doing business in the U.S. You have only 9 African-American-owned companies in this industry. And to me, that's a travesty. When we look at the fact we have 106 HBCUs, not one of them right now has any type of working relationship with the North American Board of Energy Practitioners offering online training courses in their local marketplaces to train entry-level candidates to become PV installation installers or sales representatives, which are the two fastest-growing categories, entry-level, into the solar and renewable energy industry, which the solar companies themselves are hiring. These are very, very concerning things to me when we're talking about an industry that grew at 25% it's been the fastest growing industry for jobs under President Obama's administration, and it continues to really carry the country in terms of renewable jobs that pay a livable wage. These are not jobs that you're going to be working poor person because they don't have enough of these professional PV installers with the certification and experience with a very, very high demand for their services, because the more people want to go solar, well, you still have to, you're creating jobs, but people have to be trained. And with the technology shifts and so many people being laid off in this country, it seems that it would be a win-win, colleges and universities to look at building a large-scale utility farms to offset the high energy costs at these universities, as well as create sources for markets that are don't have enough supply for CERT, like we have here in Washington, D.C. Matter of fact, I know of someone who's working on a project that right now at some universities here in the district. So I think that it makes economic sense when we begin to start raising the issue around organizations that the Clean Energy States Alliance and the role, because you play a national role in looking at bringing together financing strategies and public influence for funders around the clean energy area. And I think that engagement needs to be one of the possible things that y'all may want to look at in terms of doing just that. So I know the 30 minutes goes fast, but I want you to come on in back into this interview, because I didn't bring you on the show to do all the talking. So go right ahead, Mr.
Yeah,
Warren.
Yeah, well, let me say, and, you know, we tend, our organization, for a variety of reasons, our primary focus is not workforce development, although that's very important. I want to sort of flip it around and talk about something else that we are working on with a number of states, which I think will help lead to some of the jobs you're interested in.
Well, please do. Go right ahead.
To the extent there, you know, there's an awareness among an increasing number of states and a lot of policymakers who are concerned about the very significant inequality in this country, that as solar develops, solar could either be a force for reducing inequality or for maintaining and increasing inequality. And it's important that solar develop in a way that it actually reduces inequality and it leads to economic help for folks who need it the most. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about, well, it's hard for low-income people to benefit from solar because they don't own their own homes, or they move a lot, or they don't have good credit scores. But there are increasing numbers of strategies that folks have identified that allow solar to be developed in ways that benefit low-income residents. It can be things like community solar group projects that folks can have a share in, and it doesn't need to be on their house. It could be in a central location. It can be projects that benefit institutions like community centers and churches and food banks and homeless shelters that serve the community, and by installing solar on those institutions, it reduces those institutions' energy costs, giving them more money for the good work they're doing. And here's where it comes back to workforce development, is that as there are more installations focused on African-American communities and African-American audiences, the folks in those communities are going to look around and they're going to say, we're not going to want to do business with a solar company that doesn't have anybody who looks like us working for them. And so there'll be natural market pressure to encourage solar businesses to have a diverse workforce because they're going to want to get some of these jobs in the African-American community installing solar.
Well, to follow up on what you're saying, I think Mrs. Anna Schulman, who has a group called the Community Empowerment Network, here she has in Washington, D.C., it's called D.C. Suns, and they work, they're a nonprofit organization that works now local and nationally, and they do just what you've indicated, Leon. They, in fact, work with the community to educate them on how to do bulk buys and solar panels, the different types of solar panels, and how to select an installer. And they talk to the communities to let them know that what their areas of concern is, if they want to look at the management, the ownership, the diversity in employment and their hiring practices, they have the right to ask those questions directly to the installation company, and that gives the consumer a lot of power, as you said. As these companies come into the marketplace wanting to do business in putting these PV systems on people's homes. So I think that's a very, very, very important point, and it's one of the things that we try to stress on this show, Solar Now and the Future, with its economic impact on Black America, is that we do have a say with our dollars if we organize. And that is the key focus of getting the communication out and the community engagement around these issues. Because I will assure you, there's no one been beating at my door, and we've been producing this podcast now for almost 10 months. And I think we do a pretty decent job in what we do, in terms of reaching out to bring in very, very diverse guests such as yourself that bring a different perspective on how to look at the situation. And I want to thank you for taking time from your very, very busy schedule to come on the airways of Solar Now and Future and talk about the Clean Energy States Alliance and what your organization, CEA, does. And I think that as well, much needed, and if anything that you would like to say in closing, please do.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, and I want your listeners to know that there are lots of efforts going on around the country to try to ensure that solar does reach the African American community. Those efforts aren't sufficient. There's more that needs to be done, but there's a lot more going on now than there was 2 years, 3 years, or 5 years ago, and hopefully we'll see some good progress in the next few years.
Well, sir, I want to thank you for once again for engaging our listening audience. And our listening audience, you could call in at 646-668-2948. Because we have a very, very another special segment of this show that I'll be doing it that's going to sort of flip the script away from solar. But in the meantime, Mr. Warren Leon, you will not be a stranger to the airways of this show. And if there's any time that you would like to come on this format, you'll have an open invitation to the airways of Solar Now and the Future, with its economic impact on Black America. And once again, sir, thank you very, very much for taking time from your very, very busy schedule to join us on these airways.
And thanks very much for inviting me. Good luck with your important efforts. Bye now.
Thank you very much. And that was Mr. Warren Leon. We're going to try to take a brief pause, and we're going to sort of flip the script on this show, on our show today, because we have a special dedication. As I said, we have a very, very special dedication to some two individuals that are very, very close to me, and I'm going to be doing a closing segment of our show. The last portion on our show will be on these two individuals who I think made it better that they passed through here. And I'm not of the so-called preaching. I understand when I see you touch people's lives and make a difference. Well,
I hear the song worth singing. I do too. Sing it. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing. I got you. Sing it.
As I indicated to you before, this is a very, very special edition today. As we know, life is one. We come here and we leave here. Past weekend, even though it was an unfortunate matter, I had to travel to Conway, South Carolina to say goodbye to my father's youngest sister, which was the last living matriarch on the Bethay side, Sister Inez Bethay Ellaby. She was memorialized at the Cherry Hill Missionary Baptist Church in Conway, South Carolina. Reverend James H.E. was the presiding minister over the services. But my aunt, she was a very, very, very dynamic lady. She was the mother, grandmother, gifted educator, devoted Christian, and a dedicated community servant. She was born in Dillon, South Carolina, to the late Sylvester and Bessie Moody Bethay. She was the youngest of the last surviving of four children, Wilma, Mina, Walt, Margaret. Mrs. Ellaby graduated from Latimer High School in Atlanta, South Carolina, received a bachelor's degree in early childhood education from Morris College in South Carolina in 1949. She was united in marriage to her beloved husband, the late Gilbert G.V. Ellaby Jr. in 1949. They were deeply committed to their family and were proud parents of five children. She was preceded in death by her daughter, Lanita Watt McCoy, and grandchildren, Gilbert Elber IV, and the one great-grandchild, Carrie Wilmington. And she was the educator in South Carolina for more than 30-plus years, teaching in youth in Marion County, Horry County, and in a popular community, Myrtle Beach and Homewood. Her achievements as an educator were recognized as being named Teacher of the Year. She was a faithful Christian, receiving her orientation at Wesley Chapel, AME Church in Atlanta, South Carolina. And I could go on and on and on, but I truly want to send a shout out to my family and let them know that your mother will be deeply missed. Inez meant the world to all of us, and she touched the lives of many. Now, this show today, I mentioned another individual that I was going to talk about, who was a very, very close friend of me, of mine, and he was like family. His name was Zema Williams. We know him as Chief Z. Zema's story, Zema Williams was born July 7, 1941. Today's date signifies the 1 year of this brother passing through the Washington, D.C. community. Zema Williams was born July 7, 1941, the only son of the late Arthur and Norma Williams Colquitt in Colquitt Town, where sharecropping and picking cotton were commonplace to make ends meet. Shortly after completing high school, Zema was drafted, served his country in the U.S. military. He finished his military service at Fort Riley, Kansas in 1960 and returned home to Jacksonville, Florida, where he drove delivery trucks for a while. His adventurous spirit led him to travel to New Jersey, where his father lived, to look for better opportunities. Needless to say, his road trip stopped in Washington, D.C., and as we say, the Lord works in mysterious ways. As gas ran out of gas in Washington, D.C., which was to become his home for a minute. During the time was best known to start a new career in car sales, Zema's big personality met with career match, perfect match for cars. He started at KTK Chrysler, which quickly became the top producer. Zema was also a diehard fan and of the Washington Burgundian Gold, who became his passion. He was determined to be the number one super fan and later became well known as the supporter of that team. He was known as the man who put the soul in the burgundy and gold, and we watched him entertain for over 30 years on the sidelines those who attended the game of the hometown Burgundy and Gold NFL franchise. And as respect to our native brothers and sisters, we prefer to refer to the hometown team as the Burgundy and Gold franchise. Zema did a outstanding job working in this community, and I know this firsthand because I worked with him as a managing him early in his career through the Black Sports Legends Foundation, which we have established today. We had a firm called the Origins Marketing, to lead the sports marketing company, and we helped to get Zema out and help brand his brand as we know it today. He was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. There's a real interesting story. When you begin to talk about individuals who have played a significant role in an individual's life, you would think that the Burgundy and Gold and the Dallas Cowboys organization, which we all know as their rival, has over the years, but in a lot of strange ways, Dallas treated Zema better than the hometown franchise. I know. I traveled on several of the trips to Dallas. I know that the expenses were taken care of by Dallas. I understand people might have thought, but what they thought is just what it was. It was a thought. They didn't know. But I know the sacrifices that this brother made to get out to the community and to keep his image in a positive way, even though people had negative comments to say about him, not knowing anything about his DNA and his bloodline, knowing that he had full-blooded Cherokee in his bloodlines coming out of Jacksonville, Florida. It's always interesting to me for people to say what they say and not know what they say and how it impacts when they don't know what they're talking about in the first place, but the people say what they say. So nobody really cares what people say when you know who you are. And Chief definitely knew who he was. So we always looked at it from that standpoint. And today's date represents the sunset ceremony, which I had the privilege of being one of the speakers of expression. Mark Mosley, Daryl Grant, myself, Ron DeFay, Chris Lofton, and Earl Q, we all, 1 year ago, had an opportunity to say goodbye to a very, very, very dear friend. And as I close out this edition of this show, this today on Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact, like I said, it's a very, very interesting scenario. Before to know how you perceive, Zema was loved by people in the Washington, D.C. community. He couldn't dress and go any place and not be swarmed. And to think about how he got treated from a financial standpoint and the monies that he would have made if the local franchise would have simply endorsed him, to me, is a travesty. So my friend is gone now. But I'm going to tell it like it is, not like it ain't. So many of you listening to this show, once again, would say, well, what does this have to do with soul energy? It has nothing to do with it whatsoever. But because I created this format and we spend our time and energy trying to cultivate and educate our community, I wanted to make people know that he's not forgotten. And today marks the 1 year anniversary of Chief Z's internment. So, in closing our show today, we want to thank those who called in, attempted to call in, and in the future we hope that you will call in. And you can always do that by calling 646-668-2948 and press 1 on the phone pad. We're going to leave our show open for another about maybe 10 minutes before we close out today. And once again, we are going to let people know that this show is brought to you by, we have a new sponsor, Scotton Communications Network, specializing in the following areas: public relations, writing, editing, web development, web editing, magazine production online and traditional, newsletter production online and traditional, speech writing, book writing, editing and publishing, and a speaker's bureau management. You can contact Dr. Gwendolyn Scotton by emailing her at scottoncommunicationsnetwork.com. All one word, scottoncommunicationsnetwork.com. And this show is also, as you know, brought to you by the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative. And the slogan for our show, power in numbers. Then the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative captures that power for your financial benefit. And the Black Sports Legends Foundation HBCU Solar Initiative. And the slogan for the Black Sports Legend Foundation is history, culture, education, social change, economic justice, breaking down the barriers through the field of sport. And you can go to that website at www.legendsfoundation.org. You will find out that you will have some very dated information there, but we're working tirelessly to come up with the necessary underwriting dollars to take care of everything that needs to be done. And as we've said time and time again on this show, that you can go to our website at www.positivechange.com. That's www.positivechangepc.com, and you can click on our news and events tab. And it seems as though we're not going to get any more calls today. And we'll see if our signature, which you just heard recently, and we're going to get on out of here in a few minutes here. But as
life is a song worth singing, I can tell, sing it. Life is a song worth singing, why don't you sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand, use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan, change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing.